Welcome to the President's Inbox, a CFR podcast about the foreign policy challenges facing the United States. I'm Jim Lindsay, Director of Studies at the Council on Foreign Relations. This week's topic is Ethiopia's Civil War. With me to discuss the fighting in northern Ethiopia between federal government forces and regional Tigrayan forces is Michelle Gavin. Michelle is Senior Fellow for Africa Studies at the Council. She was previously Managing Director of the Africa Center. From 2011 to 2014, she was U.S. Ambassador to Botswana, where she served concurrently as the U.S. Representative to the Southern African Development Community. Before that, Michelle was a Special Assistant to President Barack Obama and the Senior Director for Africa on the staff of the National Security Council. Michelle, thanks for being here.
Thanks so much for having me.
Michelle, Afghanistan is dominating the news as we're speaking, so I think a lot of people haven't heard or followed what's been happening in Ethiopia. Maybe we could just start by you laying out for us how things currently stand in Ethiopia.
Sure. Well, unfortunately, the situation in Ethiopia has really gone from bad to worse. So fighting that began last November between the Tigrayan forces and the state of Tigray in Ethiopia and federal government forces very quickly brought in additional armed groups. That would be the military of the country of Eritrea, but also some Amhara militia. What we have now are even more actors, even more armed groups involved in the fighting. And we have a geographic sort of expansion of the conflict beyond the borders of Tigray itself into Afar and Amhara states that border on Tigray. So essentially, you have more armed elements in the mix, fighting over a larger swath of territory. The humanitarian crisis, which has captured so much of the world's attention, persists and in some ways has gotten worse as the sort of choke points for bringing food and other types of assistance to people in need have essentially narrowed down to one. There is one way that we're getting humanitarian assistance to Tigray, and it's not getting in fast enough.
Let's talk about how we got to this stage. Later, we can talk about where we're likely to go, potential for diplomatic mediation and the rest. But I'm trying to understand why the fighting broke out in the first place. Now, Ethiopia is a country of roughly 110 million people. I have seen estimates that Ethiopia has as many as 90 different ethnic groups. Tigray is a state in the northern part of Ethiopia. Tigrayans constitute about 5% of the Ethiopian population. How is it that we ended up in a situation in which such a small group of people is in a battle with the central government?
Well, you have to step back in Ethiopian history a bit.
History is good. We love history on the President's Inbox.
Great stuff. Because the TPLF, Tigrayan People's Liberation Front, was sort of the dominant actor in kind of establishing the ethno-federalist state of Ethiopia that we've known and understood for the last couple decades. That state was governed by a coalition, the EPRDF, right, which is a big tent of a number of different largely ethnically or regionally based parties. But there was very much a one dominant party among them, and that was the TPLF. So you're absolutely right. It's a minority population. But for many years, they enjoyed kind of pride of place, first among equals in the Ethiopian political system. And that also filtered through into the security services. You had much of the senior officer corps coming from Tigray, and also to some degree, the economy. So you had this period of TPLF dominance that was also characterized by fairly autocratic governance style. There are a lot of sort of unresolved political issues in Ethiopia right now. And under the TPLF, when those issues would bubble up, there was a pretty repressive state response to people voicing dissatisfaction or dissent with the way Ethiopia was governed, the way land tenure works, access to opportunity. So when the current prime minister of Ethiopia, Abiy Ahmed, came to power, it really represented a kind of decisive pivot away from this period of TPLF dominance.
So Abiy becomes prime minister when?
So Abiy Ahmed came to power in 2018 and had quite a successful, in many ways, kind of honeymoon period where he announced a set of political reforms, political prisoners were released, lots of very prominent members of the Ethiopian diaspora who had fled the country came back to sort of help rebuild a new Ethiopia that was going to have more space, more political space for dissent and discussion. He made a peace deal with Eritrea and ended up winning a Nobel Prize. So this period of euphoria. But as those underlying tensions that had existed for quite some time in Ethiopia continued to manifest, you started to see more of the same repressive tactics. But at the same time, growing tensions between the TPLF and the center. So as Prime Minister Abiy sort of removed senior Tigrayans from important posts in government and in the military, you started to see a lot of resentment, a sense of disenfranchisement, a growing estrangement. And when Abiy formed a new political party, the Prosperity Party, so abandoning that old EPRDF model, the TPLF declined to join in. It's a pretty clear signal that these entities were going their separate ways.
So is it safe to say that Prime Minister Abiy was pretty effective in sort of easing the TPLF out of the government?
Yeah, I think it is. I think it is. Certainly effective in that sense, but perhaps less effective in doing so in a way, right, that kind of retained the capacity to work with the TPLF. So I'm not interested in assigning blame necessarily for why exactly this political relationship foundered so badly, but it certainly did. Then you had sort of some precipitating events. So the COVID-19 crisis caused a postponement in Ethiopia's national elections. And this was a bit problematic in the sense that Ethiopia's own constitution didn't really allow for this. You had a government in Addis that was sort of standing on constitutional quicksand for a while there. And the Tigrayan regional government, which is dominated by the TPLF, decided to go ahead with elections on time in defiance of federal authorities.
This is what, in September of last year?
So yes, these elections went forward in Tigray in September of last year while they were postponed, right, in the rest of the country. And this led to kind of an escalation in the angry rhetoric between the two entities where the Tigrayans claimed the federal authorities had no legitimacy because of these constitutional issues. The federal authorities claimed that whole electoral exercise was illegitimate. So it's getting harder and harder for these groups to even talk to each other as they delegitimize one another. And you start to see, even before the fighting broke out in November of last year, you start to see military movements. You start to see what looks like preparation for armed confrontation.
Before we talk about the actual outbreak of hostilities, Michelle, can you give us a sense to what extent ethnic or tribal differences figured into this growing separation between the central government and Tigray? I ask because there's been a lot of commentary on the fact that Prime Minister Abiy is an Oromo, which is the largest ethnic group in Ethiopia. But I don't know whether the sort of evolution of Ethiopian politics is really driven by these ethnic differences or not.
It is and it isn't, in the sense that because Ethiopia has been set up on this kind of ethno-federalist model, a lot of grievances and sort of areas of political tension find expression, right, through ethnicity or regional basis. But it's not necessarily about identity so much as it is one's kind of rights, economic opportunities, access to land and resources. A lot of that depends on kind of what part of Ethiopia you sit in and how it's been carved up. And that usually is framed with an ethnic identity. And as we're seeing now, all of these states have their own kind of regional militia forces, which have now been mobilized as part of this conflict. So you have, you know, regional governing leaders who've organized around ethnic identity. You've got armed forces that are organized the same way. And so almost every conflict and sort of political point of contention can find expression through this lens. But it's not necessarily, it's not about deep-seated hatreds of the other. It's, You know, it's about how opportunities get spread out across this vast country.
So fighting breaks out last November. At the time it happened, there was a lot of uncertainty about what had actually happened. The story from the Ethiopian central government is that Tigrayan forces had attacked an Ethiopian central government military base to take weapons. I'm not sure whether that story has been shown to be true or not, but can you sort of just explain to us what happened originally and how the fighting went early on?
Well, that's certainly what was reported, that there had been a sort of preemptive strike, that the TPLF had attacked federal forces because they believed an attack on them was imminent. You know, there are different now kind of revisions of that history. I don't have access to information that gives me, you know, confidence. I know all the facts.
Well, that's a major problem right now because there aren't a lot of reporters on the ground being able to report the news accurately and quickly. That's at least my impression from what little news I can find.
It's a huge problem. Access to information is a huge problem. Disinformation is a huge problem. There's a tremendous amount of kind of propaganda out there in a really toxic information environment where you have kind of a binary choice about who you are and where you stand. Any criticism of the federal government, you're automatically a TPLF sympathizer. Any criticism of the TPLF and its choices, and you're on the side of the forces of genocide. It's really not a very, you know, helpful environment for getting any kind of political dialogue going. So very quickly then, after that attack, this conflict broke out. And very quickly as well, it came to involve four different armed groups, not just two, which is fairly shocking, right? Given the history between Ethiopia and Eritrea, the notion of Eritrean forces in Ethiopian territory, not necessarily under Ethiopian command. It's still, to me, quite a shocking idea.
Did those Eritrean forces come in at the invitation of the Ethiopian government? Did they see fighting break out and decided to protect their own interests? They had to intervene, some combination of the two?
It's completely unclear. For a long time, you had authorities in Addis denying that they were even present when they were there, then claiming that they would leave. They still have not. Whether or not they were invited, whether this was part of a plan, a military plan to kind of disarm the TPLF and eliminate any perceived threat there, it's all tremendously unclear. That's also part of the problem, is the credibility of a lot of the key actors here has been so tarnished that diplomats and parts of the international community kind of working to try and de-escalate the situation don't have a lot of confidence in statements coming from important leaders.
Okay, so the Eritreans intervened on the side of the Ethiopian central government against Tigrayans, but you mentioned four military forces. What would the fourth be?
So too did Amhara militia forces.
And who are they?
And in part, as part of a desire to lay claim to parts of Western Tigray that the Amhara believe should belong to them, there's a longstanding kind of dispute over whose territory it really is.
So Amhara is a state or province in Ethiopia.
That's right. And the Amhara are, you know, a group that before Tigrayan dominance enjoyed a lot of power in Ethiopia. They're a very important part right now of Prime Minister Abiy's constituency.
So my sense is, Michelle, that the fighting early on really went in favor of the Ethiopian military and its allied forces. But that changed earlier this summer and the Tigrayans turned the tables. Can you sort of walk us through how that fighting progressed?
Sure. Well, you're right. Early on, the Tigrayans suffered very serious losses. Kind of what was left of the TPLF sort of melted away to fight a guerrilla war and reconstitute itself in the mountains. And, you know, there is a great deal of military experience in the TPLF. They also appear to have had a lot of success in recruiting formerly civilian Tigrayans. And, you know, the reporting suggests that this is because of the brutality and the atrocities that were seen in the first part of this conflict. Attacks on healthcare facilities, widespread sexual violence and rape, just a really horrifying set of conditions that appear to have rallied within Tigray more support for the TPLF. So eventually, the TPLF appears to have been able to kind of turn the tide of this conflict. And you had a few months ago a very surprising surprising and precipitous withdrawal of federal forces from Tigray, a kind of unilateral declaration of a ceasefire from the federal government that appears to have been kind of a response to very serious military losses that federal forces had sustained.
My impression is that call for a ceasefire didn't lead to an actual ceasefire. And if I'm not mistaken, Tigrayan forces have now moved into both Amhara and Afar. If I understand the geography of Ethiopia correctly, the latter movement is potentially strategically significant because it gives the TPLF, at least in theory, the ability to cut off Ethiopia's rail and road access to Djibouti and the sea, where I believe something like 95% of Ethiopia's trade comes through, which has led to a big argument about what objectives do the TPLF now have. Do you have any sense of where the TPLF is headed? Are they simply securing their surroundings, or are we looking at the beginnings of a march to Addis?
I wish I knew, but you're absolutely right in your observations. You know, the so-called ceasefire also seemed to come with essentially a state of siege where there was no access to Tigray for humanitarians, for journalists. It was difficult for anyone in Tigray to access banks. So that the TPLF's public statement suggests, you know, well, we can't live in a state of siege. And they claim that the push into Afar is about, you know, ensuring that they will not be encircled in this way. But you now have reports that the TPLF has made common cause with the OLA, the Oromo Liberation Army, which is another entity that's been declared a terrorist group by federal authorities. It's a kind of a splinter of an Oromo opposition movement. It's difficult to see what that has to do with siege or fear of encirclement, right? And so there is speculation that the TPLF may intend to try and unseat the current government of Ethiopia, which was, of course, elected just recently in elections that certainly were problematic in that they couldn't be held in lots of insecure parts of Ethiopia. It is important to note that the fighting in Tigray is not the only serious civil conflict in this very complex state. So there appears to be a sense that they have the upper hand, that the TPLF believes it has the upper hand militarily, and that they're not going to stop now, which is incredibly dangerous, of course. And now you have Prime Minister Abiy calling on all Ethiopians, essentially, to take up arms and join the fight. So you've got ethnic militia being mobilized from entirely new states that hadn't been a part of this conflict before. The notion of kind of a mass mobilization, all of which, of course, is a recipe for a human rights disaster.
These militias don't have a lot of training and may not be well led.
Exactly. And you know, to be fair, similarly, on the Tigrayan side, this sudden recruitment, right, of angry Tigrayans who were shocked at the treatment they endured in the earlier stages of this conflict, these too are not professional fighters. And you do quite recently have reports of communities having been raised by TPLF fighters on the advance. So you're getting less professional fighters from more places with different agendas. It's not clear to me that Prime Minister Abiy can actually control all of these forces, that he could get them to stand down if he asked them to. And it feels very much like a conflict spiraling out of control.
Let's talk about that spiraling out of control. One of the things that can happen when countries are faced with great internal conflicts is someone comes along and tries to mediate, offers good offices. Have we seen any action on that front, whether from regional neighbors or the Africa Union?
Well, absolutely. You had, you know, recently the Sudanese offer to try and mediate between the Tigrayans and the federal government. This was quickly rejected, and not surprisingly in some ways, because there is right now a border conflict with Sudan and Al-Fashaga. There's a fraught set of diplomatic issues that Sudan, Ethiopia, and Egypt are unsuccessfully at this point working through around access to Nile waters. But you also just recently had Turkey offer to mediate between Sudan and Ethiopia and to try and assist with this internal conflict as well. So I think that very few international actors can look at the prospect of state collapse in a country 110 million strong in the Horn of Africa.
I think it's the 12th most popular populous country in the world.
That's right. It's a very large population in a strategically very important part of the world that had for many years, Ethiopia for many years was an exporter of security, right? Providing peacekeeping forces in South Sudan, in Somalia, and a real diplomatic heavyweight in the region, now potentially exporting instability. There are many conflicting interests in the Horn of Africa, many external actors in competition with each other for influence and access, but this is in no one's interest.
Michelle, are we seeing any evidence that other countries other than Eritrea are intervening in the conflict? You made a passing reference to the tensions between Ethiopia and Egypt, having to do with Ethiopia's construction of the Grand Renaissance Dam. Have we seen any meddling by the Egyptians who are greatly threatened by the dam? Are we seeing any others who might be trying to put their thumb on the scale in terms of what's happening in Ethiopia?
Well, there are always rumors and accusations. There's a lot less evidence. So I would say this. There's a set of actors in the Gulf who are important and influential in the Horn, in Ethiopia, and in Eritrea. And this is one reason, I think, why Jeff Feltman, the new U.S. Special Envoy for the Horn, has spent quite a bit of time talking to the Emiratis, talking to the Saudis and others, in the hopes that these actors, who in some cases have provided important financing, have provided military equipment to some of the parties on the ground, particularly to the Ethiopians, that they might have influence and be able to send kind of de-escalating messages. You've had recent reports suggesting that it's possible the Ethiopians have accessed some new military equipment from Iran, which, if this is true, obviously raises concerns for a number of international actors. But again, there's lots of maybes. It's very hard to verify a lot of this information. And you do have the Ethiopian government in Addis, you know, suggesting that there are foreign hands involved assisting the TPLF, that there are imperialist machinations afoot. And again, very difficult to find any evidence for this either.
You mentioned the diplomacy of U.S. Special Envoy Jeff Feltman. Maybe, Michelle, I could get you to put your old NSA senior director hat on and sort of speak to two questions. One, what are the U.S. interests in this crisis? How are they affected? And second, what it is the United States can and should be doing?
Sure. Well, the downside risks for the United States are significant, right? A state collapse in Ethiopia, in addition to being a humanitarian disaster that would require response, means even more instability in Somalia, which is a project that for decades the U.S. has invested in trying to bring some stability to that country and get a handle on the international terrorist threat that has emanated from Somalia. It also complicates the transition in Sudan, yet another decades-long U.S. foreign policy priority to see a different form of governance in Sudan, one that is, you know, certainly not amenable to international terrorist networks. But even more importantly, there's a moment where Sudan has the opportunity to move in a more democratic direction. So you have, you know, these long-standing stabilization projects at risk from this kind of fragility. You have the potential refugee flows, which will not be contained only within Africa or the Horn of Africa, that can, again, inflame sort of the kind of populist ethno-nationalist sentiments in parts of Europe, conceivably, that are problematic, certainly for the Biden administration's overall agenda. And then you have kind of the opportunity cost piece of this, where, you know, one reason the U.S. was so enthusiastic about Prime Minister Abiy at the beginning was the prospect of an Ethiopia that was not repressive, which never looked sustainable, right? You had this sense of simmering tensions that eventually were going to boil over, but maybe a capacity to address those tensions through a political and rule-governed process, where what would emerge would be a stronger and more stable Ethiopia that could be a really important voice for African equities in all kinds of global fora. And that is necessary, right? There's all kinds of items on the U.S. agenda, from addressing climate change to global health, that really can't be addressed without African partners. That requires, though, stable states who can take a leadership role and come to the table. And you know, there was the prospect of Ethiopia playing that role. And now, of course, relations are at a very difficult place.
So if you had had to write a memo to go up to the president saying this is what we should do, what would be in that memo?
Well, contingency planning on many people's minds these days as they read the news out of Afghanistan, I hope is going full speed ahead, because the kind of military logic of this conflict appears to be toward escalation right now and expansion. So, you know, getting ready for some of the worst case scenarios, I think, is incredibly important right now. To their credit, the Biden administration has tried to find leverage and apply pressure to try and persuade the federal government in Addis to consider a political solution to this problem rather than continuing to pursue a military one. There has been some sanctions on visa restrictions. There have been visa restrictions on those found to be perpetuating the conflict on all sides of the conflict, importantly. There's certainly talk about financial sanctions. I have my doubts about whether that would move the needle here. Importantly, the U.S. has taken a position on access to support from the international financial institutions that really is essential for Ethiopia's future. Ethiopia's got a very serious debt burden. They need to engage in restructuring with the IMF, and they need U.S. support going forward. So I think that they're doing a lot of the right things in terms of looking for leverage, trying to, you know, work with other actors in the Gulf and elsewhere that may be influential here. But I note that this has not borne much fruit thus far. And I do think it's very important to start planning for things to get even worse.
On that sobering note, I'm going to close up the President's Inbox for this week. My guest has been Michelle Gavin, Senior Fellow for Africa Studies here at the Council on Foreign Relations. Michelle, thank you for joining me.
Thank you so much.
Please subscribe to the President's Inbox on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen, and leave us a review. They help us get noticed and improve the show. As always, opinions expressed on the President's Inbox are solely those of the host or our guests, not of CFR, which takes no institutional positions on matters of policy. Today's episode was produced by Zoe Collins with senior producer Jeremy Sherlock. Zoe also did double duty as our recording engineer. Thank you, Zoe. Special thanks also go out to Margaret Gatch and Anna Shortridge for their assistance. This is Jim Lindsay. Thanks for listening.